serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to remember what's been called the Forgotten War, the Korean War, from a man who witnessed some of the worst of it. John Smetana of Albuquerque, New Mexico, originally from Gary, Indiana, was a Navy corpsman serving with the 1st Marine Division in Korea. And John, I know you've answered some very difficult questions with us today, and maybe this one has a different twist.
You talked about what a good athlete you were before you got drafted, playing all those sports here in New Mexico. Did you still have a dream that maybe you could become a professional ball player?
Oh, for sure. There was a bunch of my buddies. We played together in the Navy before I went over, and we were up in Boston, and we played for District 3 Naval Shipyard. And we were pretty good. We got to play at Griffith Stadium in Washington and down the road there and had a lot of fun. And we all dreamed about it. A lot of my friends that were my age, as I said, I was like 22, 23 when I was over there. And a lot of the Marine kids, I call them kids, they were like 18 and 19 years old. Well, when we got out of the service and we were 24, 25, we were kind of old for the major leagues, but we played a lot of minor league ball. But yeah, I used to dream of it all the time. I'd love to play there. I'd love to play in Kaminsky Park. Now they got a new place. But anyway, yeah, sure, I'd love to be there. Be another Satchel Paige or somebody.
There's
yeah.
always a spot for a crafty lefty.
Yeah, you're a crafty lefty. I used to throw a lot of junk. I was called a garbage pitcher. Nothing fast, but boy, that ball can dance around. Yeah.
I want to get it straight. Even there in Korea, when you're taking your socks off and putting them under your pillow and it's 20 below out there, are you sitting there dreaming about pitching in Kaminsky Park?
I'm dreaming about keeping warm. And then maybe the other also being out there playing ball, which would be very, very, very nice. One of our great senators, Pete Domenici, he and I used to play ball together here in Albuquerque before he became a senator. He developed a knee problem and couldn't quite cut the mustard anymore, but he would come back while he was still living, and he'd pitch here for the Dukes a little bit, which was a lot of fun to get out and see him play. There was a lot of us, a lot of my friends who were good enough, I always thought, but age catches up with you. We were called over the hill.
Well, and the reason I brought it up was it wasn't just the age, and the Navy did take the best years of your life. The Korean War took the best years of your life, but it also took part of you. You were wounded in Korea. I'm sure that changed your baseball future. But before I hear the story about how you earned your Purple Heart, were there some other close calls that preceded that where things came really close to getting you?
When it came close, those mortar shells and artillery were fast and furious, and you just thought, well, if you made it through, you were lucky, or God was with you. And when I got hit, I really didn't even know it until I went back to the line, to the MLR, main line of resistance, and I started feeling this burning. I had a burning sensation. Right away, I knew that I'd been hit. I could feel the different spots on my body. So I went back to the battalion aid station, and the doc dug out the steel and stuff. I was very fortunate that I didn't have any infection, didn't hit anything critical, but I had a lot of junk in my arm, leg, wrist, hand, but I got over it, thank goodness. And yeah, you think about it all the time. You know, you say, oh, the next one might have my number on it, but fortunately, I made it.
Yeah. How often over the years, 65 years now since you left there, how often have you thought about the guys who didn't come home and what their sacrifice really means?
I'll tell you what, it's got to be the greatest thing in the world to give up your life for your country. But if we didn't do it, we wouldn't have what we have now. And I was very sorry. It was called a police action. And when Vietnam came, when we came home, we didn't have no parades either. We didn't have anything. They didn't even know we were gone, I don't think, other than our loved ones. And then for Vietnam, they didn't have any parades either. And I think patriotically, that was bad, very bad. And a lot of people didn't really know what we went through over there.
So if one of your grandkids comes to you now, and you've got a few of them, you have 5 kids, 9 grandkids, and 2 great-grandkids. If one of them comes to you and says, Grandpa, what was the Korean War all about? Why were you guys over there, and why should we care now? How do you answer that question?
That's exactly right. And I tell them, I said, well, we were over to keep our democracy clean, help people out that needed help, not to be overrun by communism or a different government than what we had. And most of them are going to school, and they understood what was going on over there. I left them with high hopes to always be truthful, sincere, love your country, love your buddies, and take care of mom and dad.
Great lessons we can all learn there. You came home from Korea, and it sounds like the wounds didn't bother you that much. You got over that pretty quickly?
Yeah, I got over that pretty fast. I had a couple where I needed a stitch or two in my hip, but that didn't bother me. I got those out in about 5 or 6 days, and nothing bothered me after I came home other than thoughts about being there. And it's kind of crazy to be there. I think everybody else felt that way too. Mentioned before, I met a friend of mine that lives here now. He was in the Army as an Army engineer, and we actually came home on the same troop ship, General Collins. We started laughing about it because there's like 3,500 of us coming home all together, Marines, Army, and whatever else was on there. And that was pretty funny.
Yeah, it's a small world. Well, and that was my next question. I asked about the physical impact, but was there a lasting mental impact of this? Did you experience flashbacks or have a hard time adjusting to civilian life after spending 2 years out there on the front lines?
The worst thing I thought was, why are we over there? Why are we there? And you're talking, feel like 50,000 people getting killed. That's quite a number of people. That's like a medium-sized city. And we all at different times thought it was kind of foolish. We didn't want it to happen, but it did. And other than that, we're back. We're going to make the best of it and try to make ourselves stronger.
Had you met your wife before the war or after you came home?
Actually, right before I left, I met her and went together for a while. I told her to go out and have a good time. I'll be back. And if we still felt the same way, we'd get married. And we did. She had our first 5 children. She had some medical problems, and she passed away. And I couldn't stand being alone, so I got remarried and was very happy about that. But, yeah, she waited for me, and thank goodness. We had a wonderful life.
And I know you spent 32 years here in New Mexico with Sandia National Laboratories, but you also found a way to stay involved in sports. And we've been getting along pretty well here, but, you know, my day job is I'm a sports announcer, and we're kind of known for not always saying the nicest things about officials. And you've been an official in baseball and basketball and football. I bet you never made a bad call, though, right?
Well, they often ask me where I left my dog or where my cane was. But where's your dog, ref? Or too bad you're missing a good game. Yeah, I started out with little kids like 9, 10 years old, and I worked my way up to college. And I was fortunate to work in a conference, a couple conferences. I love kind of basketball, I guess. Baseball, I didn't want to take the brutality of an umpire, but I think I could. But, yeah, I had a lot of good friends, amazingly, as being an official, and a lot of good buddies, a lot of good guys. And it seems like if you're thinking right and you got the good friends on your side, the fans will come around, they'll come around, and you do the best job you can, and you'll never forget any calls that you made. And you made them because you knew they were right, and you just kind of tune yourself out to the crowd. That's all you could do.
Is there a particular game or situation that stands out that you reflect back on a lot? Maybe it was a big game, maybe a controversial game, but one that you found yourself stuck right in the middle of and everybody waiting to see what you thought happened?
Not so much what everybody else thought. I was an umpire, and in football, you're right behind the defensive line. I've been run over a few times, and you don't have much protection. At least they got all those pads on. You do the best job you can and hope you call it right. Let the ref know everything you saw and let him make his decision. It was very enjoyable, very enjoyable.
Now, I always say, and especially today because the rules have changed, I say basketball is by far the toughest sport to officiate because it's so subjective and you could call something every time down the floor, but you can't. It ruins the game. What did you find was the toughest thing of being an official?
being sure what you called. Make sure you see what you see and always be consistent. Don't be haphazard. Be consistent. That's all a coach wants. If you're going to call it that way all night. Don't change in the middle of the game, because then they don't know what to expect, and neither do the players. And now at the Final Four, I just watched the other night, those guys did an excellent job. And like Paul said, rules have changed. It's how much you're going to call, how much you're going to let them play, how rough are they going to be, and it's so quick, so fast. Your decisions are so fast, and you never change. Just be yourself, do the best job you can, and be consistent. That's all anybody asks. Let them know that you're going to call it that way, and they'll play that way.
Well, and anything else that you think is relevant, I want to touch on here, John, but there's one thing I want to talk to you about, because I'm sure when you meet people here in Albuquerque, maybe even here at Paloma Landing when a new resident comes in, they might find out you're a Korean War veteran and a Purple Heart recipient, and then they see that you're missing both legs below the knees, and they probably think that happened in the war. But you've been living this way for 18 years because of peripheral arterial disease. But I see such enthusiasm in you. It doesn't seem like this is slowing you down too much or weighing you down. How's that possible?
I've always been up. In fact, people here, amazing, they say, you're amazing that you can have such an outlook on life. I said, don't let yourself crawl in a hole. You got to smile, accept everything you have. Be friendly, smile, be a good guy, a good person, help other people out, make them feel good. When you feel good, they'll feel good. I have people come up and say, you always have a smile. I said, yeah, why should I want to frown? I love people. I love to see them up and be happy. And as you get older, you want to keep your spirits up. You don't want to dig a hole or anything like that. Just be yourself, be happy, and love everything every day.
And where does that come from? What is the source of that joy and enthusiasm and hope that you're exuding here?
Fortunately, it comes from my dad. He was a laundry foreman for drivers. And in Gary, Indiana, when I was like 10 or 11 years old, he used to have one route that he liked to go on to the hotels in Gary. We would always whistle. My dad used to whistle all kinds of tunes. And I did too. And the ladies that were doing the housework in the hotel said, oh, here comes John. Here comes John with little John. And we'd be smiling. My dad would smile and we'd whistle. They're the happiest guys in the world. And that started way back when I was a kid, 10, 11 years old. I can still remember it. And I've never faltered. I've never changed. And I never will.
There's a photo here behind you where I think that is on display, because you've got about the happiest look somebody could have on your face, and you also have a couple headphones on and a little leather helmet there. You got to go up in a Stearman with Ageless Aviation Dreams, and from what I understand, that was no small feat for them to get you in that 1920s cockpit of that biplane.
That's a good question, Paul. Yes, it took 7 firemen to put me in the airplane, which was wonderful, and it took 9 to get me out, and that was pretty funny. And on that airplane, you had to step at a certain place. Well, I couldn't do it because of my amputee. So they lifted me up and put me in, lifted me up and took me out. But boy, was that fun. I'll never forget it. It was a great experience. And yeah, they were wonderful.
Did they let you handle the controls at all up there?
Thank goodness, no. As we were landing, the wind was coming up. We were coming in, and I looked at the runway, and actually, you've heard of the term fishtail. Well, that's what we did. We came in at about an 85, maybe a 90-degree angle almost to the ground, and just before we hit, he straightened it out and set it down. The guy did a fabulous job, because I was a little bit scared at that time.
Well, and we've talked about Ageless Aviation Dreams a couple times on this program. They're out of Oregon, but they go all over the country providing this experience. What did that mean to you, that people would take their own plane, their own money, come to give you, as a veteran, a chance to get up and have that thrill ride?
They were fantastic. And all the guys here that got to go up, it was wonderful. One of the fellows that went up was an ex-pilot. He flew B-36s, and he knew how to fly. So this gentleman that took us up let him take the controls, and he felt wonderful. So he got to do a few, not big figure eights, but the slow roll and stuff, and he was out of his mind. It was wonderful. He had more fun than you could ever believe, and so did I. And it was very, very great for them to do that.
Well, I know one thing I haven't said to you yet, John, is thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for giving us a taste of what a corpsman went through during the Korean War. I know none of us are dying to trade places with you after hearing what you went through over there. Another thing I've got to ask you, just visiting you and in your place here, I see a lot of crosses on the wall. I even see St. Francis over there, and a lot of things that are indicative of the faith you clearly have. What role has that played in your life story? And is there a spot where you say, you know, God was intervening on my behalf?
You're very right, Paul. I'm Catholic, and every Thursday here we have a service, pre-communion, and we have communion, and I do the first reading, and there you go again. I'm the happy guy, and I have a very soft voice, and I don't need a microphone. But the crosses are just a remembrance of when our Lord died, and my kids, my girls mostly, make these crosses. And my granddaughter made the one right behind you, and she was about 9 years old when she put that together. I was very proud. And all the rest are from members of the family. St. Francis, he's a good guy. I have quite a few little angels on the wall, and yes, God was on my side, and I was very happy for that. I said a lot of prayers to him, and he took care of me, and I'm very fortunate that he did.
Well, and I can tell that you look back on a lot of things that you're thankful for, but what about looking forward? Is there anything that you haven't done yet that you're hoping to do someday?
Just watch the grandkids grow up, go to all the weddings, stay healthy, be a good guy every day. And I'm very fortunate that I live here. It's very safe, very warm, good people, and I want to try to keep everybody happy.
Anything else I didn't ask you about that you want people to know?
I wish I could get out and do the 100-yard dash, but I can't do it. But that doesn't stop me. I have a motorized cart, and I'm very careful. And I'll never, I hope, as I slow down, I don't want to slow down too fast. I'll keep going every day and make every day a good day. And I'll never forget my days there serving with the other guys. I'm sorry for the families that lost loved ones, but that's the way war is, and I hope we don't have any more, and I'm just going to be thankful that I'm here, that I'm alive, and I love everybody.
That's John Smetana, 87 years old, with a resilient spirit we all would do well to emulate. That's our program for today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time on Hometown Heroes when we catch up with one of the last survivors of yet another ship that has just been discovered at the bottom of the ocean 75 years after it was sunk. Make sure to thank the veterans in your life today and let their faces, their voices, their memories be a reminder to all of us that freedom is not free.